No sooner did the couple advance this thesis than an elderly lady in the audience stood up and chided them. "What you people are doing is sick, sick, sick." And there was a spattering of applause on behalf of this normal human reaction. But interestingly, this is not the point of view that prevailed. As the show went on, the guests made their appeal to the ethic of authenticity. "This lifestyle may seem bizarre to you," they said, "but it works for us. This is something that we felt we had to do, and so we went for it. We're happy, so what's your problem with it? Who are you to impose your morality on us?" And by the end of the show, the audience was cheering this position. Although I am an immigrant, I feel the power of the ideal of authenticity. Several years ago, I invoked it in a conversation I had with my father, in which I was trying to convince him to support my decision to become a writer. His instinctive reaction was that writing was a fine hobby, but not something that a serious person should undertake as a career. He felt about writing what I feel about chess. It is too serious to be a game, but not serious enough to be an occupation. "Get your MBA," my dad advised, "and then maybe you can do something useful with your life." I tried to explain that I felt called to be a writer, and that I wanted a life that made me feel true to myself. "What you are saying," my father said, "is that there is a little being that lives inside of you. Let's call him Little Dinesh. Little Dinesh apparently has the wisdom and authority to run your life, and apparently you communicate and converse with Little Dinesh. You worry that you have lost touch with him, and you are eager to renew contact. You feel that becoming a writer will allow you to stay on intimate terms with Little Dinesh." My point isn't that my father disagreed with me. He didn't know what the heck I was talking about. The ideal of authenticity now helps to define what it means to be an American. Beyond our shores, many people find it incredible and incomprehensible. Even within the United States, it is controversial. Many cultural conservatives react to it with fear and loathing. Irving Babbitt's famous critique of Rousseau anticipates many of the charges we hear today. Babbitt sees Rousseau as simply weird, exhibiting an eccentricity so extreme as to be almost or quite indistinguishable from madness. The ethic of authenticity, Babbitt writes, undermines the Christian notions of sin and individual self-restraint. Self-fulfillment is, in Babbitt's view, another term for selfishness. Babbitt alleges that Rousseau is an advocate of a new form of immorality that is all the more dangerous because it is presented in aesthetically alluring garb. Babbitt's indictment has been echoed in recent years by cultural conservatives such as Alan Bloom, Patrick Buchanan, Bill Bennett, and Robert Bork. These men would like nothing better than to uproot the ethic of authenticity and restore the moral consensus that existed in the 1950s. The problems with this root and branch repudiation of contemporary ideals can be seen by considering an example, which I offer as representative of the whole culture of authenticity. Recently, I stopped into my neighborhood Starbucks, and there behind the counter was a specimen who probably would not have existed in earlier generations. I surveyed him with curious fascination, the mohawk hair, the earrings, the nose ring, the studs on his tongue and forehead, the tattoos. I could just imagine Judge Bork entering the room. His immediate reaction would probably be, "Arrest that man." Since this is not practical, another option would be to grab the young fellow and yell, "What is wrong with you, you demented freak?" From Bork's point of view, there is simply no excuse for some people. But what good would come of this? The epithets and remonstrations of the conservative have no chance of persuading the Starbucks guy. Indeed, likely to have the opposite effect. "Get away from me, you fascist." From the Starbucks guy's perspective, the cultural conservatives are enemies of freedom. He would undoubtedly regard Judge Bork as a self-righteous mullah who is trying to tell him how to live his life. The Starbucks guy believes that he has the inalienable right to determine his own destiny, to make his own choices. Thus, he regards the conservative approach as presumptuous, coercive, and un-American. and he is reluctant to listen to anything these conservatives have to say. The Starbucks guy's objection to the conservatives is valid on two counts. First, many conservatives do sound like they are against freedom. Bork, for example, has urged the enforcement of public morality through the censorship of objectionable songs, movies, TV shows, and internet websites. Buchanan heartily agrees, calling state censorship an idea whose time has come. Some religious and political activists have gone further, demanding laws that enforce Christian precepts or the norms that prevailed in the 1950s. I cannot see how such strategies could possibly work. Is it realistic for a democratic society to enforce norms based on a moral order that is no longer shared by the community? How can a political strategy that defines itself against America's core value of freedom possibly succeed? Cultural conservatives must recognize that the new morality is now entrenched and pervasive, so that there is no way to go back to the shared moral hierarchy of the past, however fondly that era may live on in their memories. Second, the root and branch rejection of authenticity ignores the moral force of this ideal. Contrary to what the cultural conservatives fear, the new morality is not simply a screen for self-indulgence and immorality. If you were to sympathetically engage the Starbucks guy in conversation and ask him to account for himself, he would probably say, "I am trying to be unique. I want to be an individual. I am trying to be me." Some may find these aspirations banal, even comical, but the goals for which the Starbucks guy is striving are legitimate ones. Even at the cost of bodily pain, he wants a distinctive identity, a life that is not simply a copy of other people's lives. In short, he wants a life that counts. I do not think that it is either right or prudent to attack him for this. The Starbucks guy is an idealist, and it would be wrong to trample on that idealism. Moreover, his ethic of authenticity is entrenched in his psyche. How realistic would it be to uproot it? A much better approach for conservatives is to acknowledge the legitimacy of the ideal of authenticity, but to make the case that the Starbucks guy has adopted a debased form of it. The Starbucks guy wants to be original, and this is a good thing to be, but it may be pointed out to him that he is not succeeding in this, because every fourth guy at Starbucks looks like him. Perhaps there are more meaningful ways for the Starbucks guy to convey his individuality, through art, for example, or by dedicating himself to a cause he believes in. Instead of completely denying the value of expressive freedom, conservatives would do better to embrace it, at least in part, and to focus on educating people about the rich moral sources of freedom and about how to use freedom well. But the conservative is not the only one who needs to change. The Starbucks guy does too. He needs to realize that his bold stance against the institutions of society, against commerce, against family, against community, against morality, is a bit of a pose. Indeed, it fails by its own standard. It is inauthentic. After all, it is our rich, commercial society that makes an establishment like Starbucks viable. It is the legal, social, and moral norms of the community that provide the guardrails protecting the Starbucks guy's freedom and autonomy. Moreover, it is the hard work, discipline, deferred gratification, and frugality of his parents over the years that now enable the Starbucks guy to enjoy his bohemian lifestyle. True, the Starbucks guy is in a situation different from his parents, but they are the ones who have placed him there. In short, a little gratitude and understanding should not be too much to expect from the Starbucks guy. In addition, champions of authenticity and moral autonomy like the Starbucks guy should understand that identity is not completely self-generated and that freedom is not its own justification. Our identity and self-image emerge out of our relationships with others. Even the Starbucks guy's studs and tattoos are an attempt to communicate something to somebody. Ultimately, this expressive freedom must have some underlying purpose. Freedom becomes insignificant if it makes no difference what I choose.